This is main audio book in MP3 of Flying Saucer Pilgrimage, Fall, 1965. By Bryant Reeve, Helen Reeve. Found on archive.org. Scanning, text mistakes may be here. Random numbers read are probably page numbers. Chapter 1, How IT All Started. Henry was talking. Here's a man who claims he saw a flying saucer and talked to the pilot. He says the pilot was from Venus. Henry is a fabulous person. He had, as usual, without the slightest warning, burst into our home in Detroit, Michigan. Anything new, exciting, beautiful, imaginative, physical or metaphysical, in this world or out of it would excite Henry to a fever pitch. It was November, 1953, and we were entertaining guests. Although the hour was late, it did not deter dear Henry. How insane can these fellows get? Said I, not a little annoyed. How gullible do they think we are? Exclaimed one of our guests. No, honestly, cried Henry. This is serious. This man has written a book on it. I sat up all night reading an advance copy. It is called Flying Saucers Have Landed and was written by Desmond Leslie and George Adamski. Here it is. Let's see it, came an excited chorus. Everybody tried to grab it at once. Being an engineer, a college graduate, and employed by a staid and respectable manufacturing firm, I really felt it was up to someone to exhibit, shall we say, a little dignity and common sense. Besides, I had never heard of flying saucers, except through a few obscure references in newspapers which always ridiculed them, as of course any sane editor would, and should. So I sat back utterly disgusted while the guests and, may I add, my wife Helen pawed at the book like three-year-olds going after candy. Look, it has photographs, real photographs of flying saucers, shouted a guest. Photographs my eye, I yelled over the hubbub. The man's a fake. How does he think he can get away with this? He ought to be. No, I feel the fellow is really sincere, put in Henry. And besides, an Irishman in the first part of the book says there are lots of historical records about these things. That respectful reference to the Irish slipped by unchallenged as the controversy in our home became hotter and hotter. The evening grew later and later. If there is even a slight chance of this thing being true, it is the biggest thing in the world, exclaimed my wife. There's only one thing to do, said Henry dramatically, call the man up and get him to Detroit. Where's the phone? That was Henry for you. Direct action always at any cost. It was our telephone, but we were all used to Henry. Before I could open my mouth, he had placed a long-distance telephone call to one Mr. George Adamski in Valley Center, California, a man we never knew existed until a few hours previously. A tense silence settled over the room as we all waited for the operator to call us back, a hush of excited expectancy. My wife Helen was on an extension telephone with pencil poised to take notes. What a contrast to the previous bedlam. The bell rang. Henry made a beeline for the phone and got the first. The rest all crowded around. Henry said, hello, operator, hello. Is this Mr. George Adamski? No? Operator. You say he has no phone. No phone. Well, thought I secretly, that ought to end this crazy business. Good riddance. But this turned out to be wishful thinking. I had momentarily forgotten Henry, who was still burning with that unquenchable fire for things unusual and mysterious. Look, he suddenly burst out, is it worth $10 apiece to you to get George Adamski to Detroit to find out the truth about this thing? The way he said it made you feel like a groveling piker. A downright worm, if you did not immediately jump to your feet with checkbook in hand to support so glorious and worthy a project. Grudgingly I said, sure, but... Henry interrupted, oh, I know what you're thinking. $10 isn't enough. Confidentially at that time my thoughts were along a rather opposite line, But before I could say a word, Henry settled the matter by exclaiming inspirationally, "Then I'll write Adamski tomorrow and invite him to Detroit to talk to us, and we will all work to get 40 people to put up a like amount to cover expenses." Well, folks, that's the story one. That is the breathless way we got started on a flying saucer pilgrimage. Funny thing is, we didn't realize until later the amazing path we had embarked upon. But it has been pretty breathless all the way. Little did we realize the interesting saucer people we were to meet, the places we were to go, the fascinating experiences that lay ahead of us, and above all the earth-shaking revisions in our basic life concepts that would occur in our quest for. What? What was this pilgrimage all about? What were we after? What was driving us? What was the goal? Maybe we should blame Henry. Maybe some of his burning white-hot enthusiasm for the unknown, the mysterious, the fantastic, the mystical, the impossible, rubbed off on us. But the goal really became just one thing: to know the truth about flying saucers. The plain unvarnished truth. Shorn of all propaganda, all pros and cons, all hooey, we did not want opinions. We wanted facts. Facts that we could put our teeth into and hang on to and know that we had something solid. We wanted to convince ourselves, one way or the other. Now, if some of you readers feel this same way, we invite you to relive with us our flying saucer pilgrimage, our search for the truth. We are not interested in convincing anyone else of anything. Far from it. That is not our purpose. But so many sincere people have asked us to tell them what we found out about flying saucers, that we decided we would try not only to tell about our experiences, but try to give our readers the feel of them so that all may judge for themselves. We will try to be good and forthright reporters at all times, telling you factually, to the best of our ability, of our experiences. Above all, we will try to label our impressions as such, our conclusions as such, and any philosophizing we do as such, as our own, which you may accept or repudiate at will. This will leave you free to make up your own minds. If you come to different conclusions than we did, fine. No harm done at all. Each to his own. We are all individuals, with different viewpoints, all in different states of evolvement. Surely we are mature enough to respect each other's views without quarreling or giving way to undue emotionalism. It would be a dull world if we all thought alike, wouldn't it? So here we go. Take it easy, because we are about to take you on a journey of flying saucer research which covers over 2 years of time and more than 23,000 miles of travel. And let's argue all we wish, but let's enjoy the ride, the meetings, the sights, the experiences, our flying saucer pilgrimage. Chapter 2. 1. The saucers start coming to Detroit. What is the right name for a person who contacts a flying saucer or a spaceman, or has some outstanding saucer experience? Helen asked this question one bright March morning in Detroit in 1954. Well, I know some names the public calls them, likewise the newspapers, I replied. No, that's not funny, she persisted. After all, people are contacting these things, having saucer experiences, and we need a name for them. Let's see. Oh, I've got it, sorcerer. How's that, sorcerer? Wonderful, I replied. But the word sorcerer is not new, you know. We have, I believe, our British friends to thank for it. Of course the skeptics will just love it. They will think you are saying sorcerer and be delighted. Sorcerer or sorcerer, one and the same thing to them. And such levity, I suppose, suggests just why saucers levitate, snapped Helen. Let's cut this out and agree on the term sorcerer. And so we decided to use the word sorcerer. Incidentally, whoever got the idea that women needed the vote? About half of the time I try to use the chosen word, it still comes out sorcerer, but maybe down the dusty roads of eternity the two words may merge a bit, who knows? George Adamski arrives. Our friend Henry was as good as his word. He wrote to Mr. Adamski and received a really sincere and beautiful reply. Mr. Adamski stated that he would gladly come to Detroit to tell of his contact, but that since he was not a man of great means, he would need his expenses paid. That was a great day for the Detroit group. It buzzed around and soon had 40 sponsors to help finance Mr. Adamski's trip and two small lectures. The small auditorium of the Detroit Institute of Arts was engaged for this purpose. Our friends Henry and Laura and a young enthusiast named Ronnie, and my wife formed the group who worked like beavers on the project. What's more enthusiastic and joyful than a group infested with the saucer virus? Who in blazes wants to stay on just one planet anyway? Ah, that spirit of adventure. The mystery of the unknown. Here was something new, exciting and unprecedented in Detroit, the city of automobiles. After all, what is an automobile in comparison to a flying saucer? Our home came to resemble New York's Grand Central Station. The phone rang incessantly. Committee meetings lasted until late at night. Helen became so inspired she vowed that if the saucers turned out to be real, she would be a regular Joan of Arc for the cause. After that assertion, every time she ran into a group of hard-boiled skeptics, I would start wondering just who was going to burn who at the stake. Train time soon was approaching. We were about to meet a man who had met a man from outer space. Kind of a cosmic cousin once removed from outer space. Henry waxed poetic as he proclaimed he alone should have the signal honor of meeting this exceptional man at the railroad station. Was it not he, Henry, who first read the book and told us all about it? Nevertheless, the committee soundly voted him down and went in a body to meet Mr. George Adamski. There he was at the railroad station, tall, distinguished-looking, gray-haired, wearing a beret that rivaled Field Marshal Montgomery's. He was about 63 years of age. His parents had brought him from Poland when he was very young. He had to go to work at an early age and was forced to leave school. However, his self-education proved to be astonishing. He was an amateur astronomer, philosopher and metaphysician. He was certainly an interesting individual. He spoke with a slight accent, but he had a grand smile and we immediately experienced a feeling of friendship and liking for him. We hustled him to his hotel. He was our first live sorcerer in Detroit. A press conference extraordinary. One of the first events scheduled was a press conference. Representatives and photographers of the Detroit Metropolitan newspapers showed up along with those of a Windsor, Canada, newspaper. Some of these newshounds, but not all, were pretty hard-boiled skeptics. We had cocktails and luncheon, but the inquisition started almost at once. Frankly, I experienced forebodings. The scene was unforgettable. George Adamski sat at the head of the table. Back of him were blown up pictures of his telescope and his saucers. The newshounds deserted their chairs, crowded around him, and literally rained questions on their unpretentious victim. Questions were fired so fast that they overlapped each other. From our viewpoint, every approach, every ruse was being used to trip him up. We sat back in wonderment. With every passing moment, our respect and admiration mounted for this sincere and unruffled man. The questioning and photographing lasted several hours. Mr. Adamski was standing up under the barrage. He was doing more than that. He was gradually creating a miracle, a lessening of skepticism and an increase of respect. If anyone was hot and bothered, it was some of the newshounds. They were trying to move a rock, but the rock would not move. Smiling, courteous, friendly and unruffled despite some near insults, we felt that George Adamski did himself proud that day in Detroit. Next morning we all rushed for the newsstands. To our great relief, our guest had landed on some of the front pages in all his glory, and courteously though somewhat skeptically on others. I hope some of the newshounds read this book because we thought they did a marvelous job. Maybe they did not realize it, but at that time we did not know George Adamski any better than they did, although we were in the role of sponsors. Just remember that flying saucers were even more incredible and fantastic then than now. Some of us even mentally put ourselves in the reporter's boots and wondered what we would write for the papers if we had such a fantastic subject for our assignment. They handled it beautifully. They gave full vent to his story but took no responsibility for it, and they ended up with a polite, artistic and friendly question mark. After all, what else could they do? An incredible radio broadcast. However, the press publicity did not impress the radio stations. Laura approached them and was met with cold refusal. Too incredible, apartment to make us a laughing stock, can't risk it, were die general reactions. Finally, as a special personal favor to Laura, one of the large radio stations, WWJ, reluctantly consented to a 5-minute radio interview at 1 p.m. on a certain afternoon. Ross Mulholland was the redoubtable gentleman who dared take on this interview. Mr. Adamski went on the air with all the excitement behind the scenes of a premiere performance. The interview started with magnificent questions by Mr. Mulholland. Was it to go over, or was it to be a flop? We held our breath. The replies of Mr. Adamski were calm, convincing, and sensible. An unusual feeling of sincerity was sensed. A thrill stole over the broadcast room. Technicians and helpers paused in their work to listen, almost in awe, to this simple man who told of his contact on the California desert with a man from another world. Mr. Mulholland encouraged those present in the audience and the radio technicians on duty at the station to ask questions. The 5-minute deadline came, went and died, almost unnoticed. The interest mounted to a thrilled tension. Other scheduled programs were cancelled. Only station announcements and short commercials cut into the interview. That 5-minute Flying Saucer radio interview in Detroit finally ended in a burst of applause 1 hour and 25 minutes after it started. Saucer history was in the making that day in Detroit. Two small lectures. The Adamski small lectures were held in an auditorium in the Detroit Institute of Arts with a seating capacity of about 400 persons. They were limited to sponsors and their friends who wished to purchase tickets. The seats were sold out in no time, and the lectures were packed. The first lecture was entitled "What is the World Headed For?" There was no lack of interest or curiosity. Few lecturers faced a more open-minded audience. Yet after the first lecture we sensed a slight feeling of disappointment. There were not enough experiences in it and too much philosophy and preaching, so said some of our friends. The second lecture was entitled "My Experiences." It was much better than the first, and the audience as a whole was fascinated by Mr. Adamski's stirring account of his contact on the California desert with a man from outer space. He told how, with a background of amateur astronomy, he first became interested in sky phenomena, and of the many days and nights he spent out in the open with a telescope and camera. After many, many attempts, he finally obtained a few good photographs of large cigar-shaped spaceships with their small saucers or scout ships. Finally, a series of events led to his contact with a spaceman in a desolate region near Desert Center, California, on November 20, 1952. There were 6 other persons present at this meeting. He also told of unusual footprints left by the man from outer space and of how he gave to the spaceman a photographic plate holder from his camera. This article was returned to Mr. Adamski 23 days later when the spaceman returned and flew over Palomar Gardens, the place where Mr. Adamski was residing at that time. Most of the audience was delighted at this forthright account of his experiences. A few skeptics and scientists, however, voiced their disapproval, but their protests were drowned out in the general enthusiasm. After each lecture there was a question and answer period. In a lull in one of these periods a deep booming voice from the last row inquired, "Mr. Adamski, what about sex on Venus?" It was none other than Singapore Joe Fisher, the world traveler and lecturer and intrepid Britisher who knows more about South Africa and the Orient than our own State Department. A tense hush fell on the audience. One could have heard a pin drop. I did not know whether to head for the door or wait to see what would happen. Mr. Adamski considered a moment, and then with undisturbed equanimity replied, "Well, sir, if you went to Venus, I do not believe you would have to learn any new tricks." I caught a swift glimpse of a few very dignified ladies desperately trying to keep a straight face, but failing. The rest of the audience broke into such an unrestrained spasm of merriment that soon everybody joined in. This lecture we felt was really a worthwhile affair. After it was over, Mr. Adamski was given no rest but was hustled to a reception arranged by his Detroit sponsors in a nearby hotel. They all wanted a chance to meet this pioneer sorcerer personally. He was finally prevailed upon to speak, but he spoke not of sorcerers but of, will you please guess what? The answer is religion. 14. We mention this because in this book we are trying to give you a true picture of the personalities of these interesting people, these pioneer sorcerers who have labored to bring the truth about flying saucers to the public at large. We will do our best to take you along with us on our saucer pilgrimage and give you a first-hand report of what the sorcerers are like and give you a chance to judge for yourselves. I practically buy an interest in flying saucers. Calm did not settle on our home after these small lectures. Far from it. Our telephone and the sponsors' telephones rang day and night with demands to see and hear Mr. Adamski. The callers implied that we were attempting to keep Mr. Adamski from the general public. The public hit he had alerted hundreds of saucer fans now clamoring for Mr. Adamski. What to do was a question. We were not professional promoters but simple students and truth seekers. We had little knowledge as to how to go about conducting large public lectures. However, I must have underestimated our little grapple. I came home tired from work one evening and was greeted brightly by my wife Helen with the remark, "Congratulations. You've just rented the Masonic Temple." "I've just rented what?" I yelled. "The Detroit Masonic Temple, for the public to hear Mr. Adamski, only $1,200. I signed you up." To say that I was ready to give the saucers back to the Venusians was putting it mildly. By the time the atmosphere had cleared a bit, I tried to realize through a sort of blue haze just what had happened. I had practically purchased an interest in flying saucers and had become sole entrepreneur in a sort of cosmic philanthropic enterprise using the biggest auditorium in the state of Michigan to educate the dear public on spaceships. Wow! "Say," I yelled, "just don't rent Carnegie Hall in New York City until I catch my breath, I." "Now don't worry," was my wife's reply. "It's going to be all right, you just relax and wait and see." And, confound it, she was right. These women, and their vote. The big event. The marquee of the 5,000-seat Detroit Masonic Temple was blazing with Mr. Adamski's name and the subject of his lecture, Flying Saucers. I had not yet become accustomed to the difference in feeling of having a mere casual interest in saucers as compared to that of having a financial interest in same. The pre-sale of tickets had not been too encouraging, and as we entered the stage door it started to rain. "That does it," I thought, "but wait." Things were happening out in front. The ticket office was not yet open, but a large crowd had begun to line up to purchase tickets. Soon the immense auditorium began to fill with people. I was busy setting up a slide projector to use to throw original Adamski saucer photographs on a screen. Incidentally, this proved to be a flop because the light was too weak. Please remember we were rank amateurs at this business. The screen on the stage needed adjusting, and while engaged in this adjustment I saw someone tampering with the projector which I had so carefully adjusted. I rushed back and told the intruder off in no uncertain terms. While this was going on, Henry came up and introduced us, and the young man turned out to be John Otto, lecturer and researcher on flying saucers. What an embarrassing way to become acquainted with someone I had looked forward to meeting for a long time. Shortly thereafter, my wife joined me and told me it would soon be necessary to open up the balcony for practical eye. All of the 3,000 seats on the lower floor were already filled. I could hardly believe she was serious. It seemed amazing that there were so many people interested in saucers in the city of Detroit who would brave the rain on a Sunday night to hear about them. It just couldn't be, as I would not take Helen's estimate seriously. She suggested that I take a trip to the lobby and see for myself. I did so, and to my amazement the lobby was overflowing with people. Going outside, I saw a queue of people on the sidewalk to the end of the block, and the weather was still wet and nasty. I saw all this but still could hardly believe it. The balcony was opened, and 4,700 people attended that saucer lecture, the biggest of its kind to date. Unfortunately, as we viewed it, the lecture did not go off too well. As stated, the projector proved inadequate because the people in the balcony could not see the Adamski photographs of saucers. In addition, Mr. Adamski seemed under great nervous tension. He had to leave Detroit for New York that night, and no doubt he was concerned about making his train connection. The interesting details of his saucer contact so well presented at the second lecture were not forthcoming. Mr. Adamski mentioned to the audience that a woman in England had written him her interpretation of the markings on the footprints left by the Venusian in the sand on the desert, and he added that he felt the interpretation was about 90% correct. The audience clamored for the letter of interpretation to be read, and precious lecture time was spent in the reading of this lengthy letter, which we feel few people understood. The lecture ended with a question and answer period which ran into difficulties because of the size of the audience. The ending came within minutes of train time, so we had to make a mad rush for the railway station. We said goodbye to Mr. Adamski with regret. Since then we have been with him on a good many occasions, even in old Mexico. He is truly an extraordinary individual, a man of many contrasts, many moods, many ideas, and many experiences, different, so different. Chapter 3. We meet Truman Bethurum. After this first saucer invasion in Detroit via there Adamski lectures, we had a period of relative quiet. To discuss and ponder these initial footsteps in our pilgrimage to discover the meaning of flying saucers. We say relative quiet because saucer arguments went on at a lively rate in the basement recreation room of our Detroit home about every night. Willingly our home became a sort of mecca for those interested in saucers. People would call us and tell us of their own sightings or ask to come over and discuss the subject. We had made tape recordings of the Adamski lectures, and many who had been unable to attend these lectures expressed a desire to hear the tape recordings. Saucer clubs and groups were springing up almost spontaneously. In passing, may we briefly state that in the year 1952 or thereabouts there were some exceptional sightings of saucers in the Detroit area. Some of these were well attested by witnesses. We became well acquainted with some of these sightings, but it is not our purpose in this book to catalogue sightings. This has already been done far better by others than we could do it. What we are trying to relate is that saucer activity seemed to have an unseen groundswell of its own and was expanding and not contracting, and we found ourselves right in the midst of this activity. A natural phase of this interest was an effort by our group and others to discover and read all possible written material on the subject. Saucer books were in great demand, and there were more of them than we suspected at first. Some authors were cataloging and discussing recent sightings of spaceships and other sky phenomena with great earnestness and seriousness. Others were delving into past records and coming up with citations amazingly similar to the current phenomena. Still others with more of a religious or metaphysical background were scanning such writings as the Christian Bible, OSP, and works on the prehistoric civilizations of Atlantis and Lemuria for evidence of spaceships in antiquity. All these researchers seemed to be finding references to spaceships. Was it possible that these were not new phenomena? To our utter amazement, a startling mass of references from ancient records and writings seemed to point this way. Some saucer fans started compiling saucer scrap books from newspapers and periodical clippings. The size and extent of some of these were well worth noting. As for ourselves, we decided to go slow and hear everybody's side before we could permit ourselves to form any conclusions. We read everything we could lay our hands on in the way of both current and ancient material relating to the subject.